Welcome to the first podcast of Minnesota Sports Insider. You can find us on Twitter at Inside Minnesota Sports. I'm here with Brandon Gonzalez, who you can find on Twitter at Gonzino underscore Dune, Skylar Larson at Snipeaboy, and myself, Brent Petermeyer at Coach Petermeyer. Welcome, boys. How are we doing today? Our first podcast, we have some breaking news to discuss. The Timberwolves have found their new leader of the organization and president of basketball operations and former Rockets VP, Gerson Rosas. What are our thoughts on him?
Let me just say something quick. We'll get right back to that question that you're talking about with Rosas, but man, how good are the Minnesota Twins? It's impressive, right? It's an impressive start to the year. But yeah, going back to the question, Rosas, how can we adapt him with Scott Layden? And how does Scott Layden work with Rosas? Now, we know that Scott Layden has done a lot of due diligence with Kata Bates-Jopp and the scouting there and Josh Okogie. And those, I mean, look at the value of Kata Bates-Jopp. What was he, the 50th or 48th pick of the, and then in the second round when he was projected to go, what, 20th? I know it seems like an obvious, he was projected to go late first round in a lot of mock drafts. And we snag him there. Obviously, it's an obvious pick, right? But I think a lot of teams stray away when players drop. And you look at Josh Okogie, I think that was a pick where a lot of people kind of were like, whoa. And I think at 20th, you could have gone with a lot of different players. So understanding why we kept Scott Layden, I do believe it's because Glenn Taylor believes, and I think the most, you know, the Wolves brass really believe that he has eyes for talent. Can you mix that with Rosas? And I don't know what really Rosas yet can do really well of, but can he fix the problem of the guard situation?
I think Rosas, coming from the Houston Rockets, he was there for the past 16 years, and he was the VP there under Daryl Morey, who, in my eyes, Daryl Morey is one of the best general managers in all of the NBA. What he can do with and what he has done with contracts, and looking at what the Rockets have in Chris Paul and James Harden, two really ginormous contracts that translate to what Carl Anthony Towns and Andrew Wiggins have. They in Houston have had to find veterans and find free agents and find guys through the draft to be a part of the team and mesh well with those two contracts. And I think Daryl Morey has done a really good job there bringing in those type of players. And I think that Rosas is going to benefit from being there for the past 16 years and learning from that. And I think him being able to bring in those guys and get meetings with the veterans that aren't aging in the sense that they're washed up and they don't have any game left and they're just trying to stick around for the money cause. They're veterans that are going to come in and impact a team from day one, both from the leadership standpoint and from the playing standpoint.
Can I ask you a question, though? Like, let's just be honest. Like, what's the problem of the Timberwolves right now?
As far as where you mentioned before, our guard play, or what we have is the players around our contracts?
Yeah, we can get all about Jang is a huge problem, and Teague is 1 year away from a contract being done too, but he's still a huge problem, and Wiggins is too. But I don't understand, why did we sign Rosas instead of Langdon? I don't disagree with that. I just want to hear the reasoning of why he was a better option than Langdon, because in my opinion, Langdon developed or found guards that can play. He found
and value. I think Sky can touch more on this because he wrote a piece earlier on our website that if you want to go take a look at Minnesota Sports on the internet, I think that if we would have brought Langdon over, he traded for D'Angelo Russell from the Lakers, and he really developed this year into what could be a bona fide superstar in this league. And he is young, he is best friends with Carl Anthony Towns, and he's a free agent this year. So if we could have brought Langdon over, I don't know, Scott, what do you think? Could we have managed to get D'Angelo Russell into our cap space?
I think that would have been a pipe dream, but it would have been doable. Just because we bring Langdon over, there's a lot more work to be done to get D'Angelo Russell over here, because the Nets obviously want to keep D'Angelo Russell if their cap space allows for it. But yeah, that's just my quick thoughts on that.
I also think that aside from the D'Angelo Russell aspect of things, nobody really knows a lot about Langdon. I get that he is a really big name that's going to be a big-time free agent or a big-time front office guy in the next coming years. But what do we know about him? Just like what do we know about the guy we just brought over in Rosas? Nobody from Minnesota really knows what they're going to do. But I think that we got two guys now in our front office in Rosas from Houston and Layden from the Spurs that have really done a lot the past 2 years, learning under what they have learned, like been under the tutelage of those two organizations and Layden coming over from the Spurs, learning from that front office and learning from Greg Popovich. I think those two together, if they get a sit down with free agents in the coming years or veterans in the coming years, if Rosas can get those guys in, I think Layden is going to be able to get them on a team-friendly deal like they've done. Because if you look at the Spurs right now, what bad contracts do they have?
Do they have one? No, I mean, I'm with you. So if you're looking at what Rosas and Daryl Morey, I guess, have done, if you will, I have questions. First off, you have D'Antoni as the coach, correct? So how much is Daryl Morey and Rosas a part of the style play that gets implemented in the style? Is that D'Antoni mainly, or is that reinforced by administration?
The style of play, I think, is all D'Antoni. And I think Daryl Morey and Rosas have brought in guys that are going to fit his system, because that's really a special system in this league that only Mike D'Antoni has done. He has done this system throughout his time in the NBA.
Yep.
He is going to get guys that shoot threes, and they're going to shoot volume threes. They're going to win or die by the three ball. And they've done that all of this since he's been there. You look at them last year, the pieces they had on that team, they took the Warriors to 7 games in the Western Conference Finals. Granted, Chris Paul got hurt. They might have gone to the NBA Finals and taken out the 2-time champs. Could be 3-time this year. And that's what the Timberwolves are going to need to do now with these contracts that we have in our books. I think Rosas' first big job for him to do is find a trade partner for either Jeff Teague or find a trade partner for Gorgui Dieng. And I think if we can get a pick back for those, for one of those players, would be a win for us.
Yeah, and that's the tough thing. That's a big challenge. That's what Rosas and Daryl Morey, they have yet to really, they're not challenged on it yet. Because if you look at James Harden and Chris Paul, well, Daryl Morey hasn't had to deal with that yet. Let's let those contracts ride out till Chris Paul hits 35 and see how much tread he has left on those legs. And he's already having issues staying healthy for, more than 60 games a year. My thing is how can he now deal with the task of getting out of Dieng, getting out of Jeff Teague, getting out of that player option that Jeff Teague, of course, he's going to opt into. But how do you get out of those situations? And then, now, let's transition to this. Now, we find out that along with Rosas comes who?
Well, when Rosas interviewed, he made it a very vocal point that he was going to bring over one of his best friends that's with the Rockets organization. And he's one of the best strength and conditioning guys in the league. And I think that's going to go a long way for us, just for the simple fact that our guys are going to be able to train and work out with and be under one of the best strength guys in the league. Just aside from the workouts, he's going to keep them healthy and keep them on the floor.
Right.
That's going to go a long ways for Kat and Wiggins. And let's look at Rose for a minute. If we bring him back, this year was his best year since he was in Chicago until he got hurt. He was shooting a 3-point clip way better than what he shot in his career. Mm-hmm. And if he's shooting the three at, 34-35% this year before he got injured, if he would have stayed healthy all year, he was really efficient. If he hit two or three threes in a game, Now he's got defenders flying at him, and he can pump fake and get to the rim. And he's such an acrobatic finisher that he's going to finish more times than not at the rim. Or he's going to find the open guy.
I think mentality is really important with strength and conditioning. I think more than anything, it's less about the added weight and the so-called more athleticism you get, but more so the mentality to your approach of every day going through the season, every day going through your lifts. I think that matters. You look at, I know I went to NDSU, and that's not necessarily relevant, but I hear stories of why NDSU's football program is so historic. And yes, it's the coaches and it's the culture and all that, but it's also the strength and conditioning coaches. They have a huge pull. I mean, especially when you're around the guys every single day, I think that's a lot to be said for. Like, sometimes you need a different voice than hearing your head coach or your assistant coach constantly in your ear. And I think that matters. I think that matters, and that can help with the motivation. So you talked about Derrick Rose. Let's talk about Andrew Wiggins. In the perfect world, how can Andrew Wiggins benefit from, you know, this acquisition in the weight room?
I think adding everything that we've done so far in adding Rosas is really going to benefit Wiggins. But before we talk about that, let's talk about Wiggins' contract and if what we should do with that.
Yeah.
I think that when Wiggins signed his contract, everybody made a big deal about it, and everybody still does. Heck, I still make a big deal about him making upwards of $25 million for what has he done on the floor. He hasn't really produced anything from when he was the number one pick. He was supposed to be the next Kobe Bryant, the next big thing, the next superstar in this league. And when we traded Kevin Love for him, Minnesota went crazy because now we have him, and the next year we drafted Karl-Anthony Towns. So now we've got two young guys that are supposed to be the next superstars in this league. They're going to be on our team for the next 5+ years. I think that when we gave him that contract, that was something that we needed to do. Has he lived up to it?
I think a lot of people, it's easy for them, before answering that question, I'll let Skylar answer the question of, has he lived up to it? Okay, I'll let you handle that. But I want to say this. It's really easy as a fan to pile on and say, well, why did you ever think about it's a good idea, Glenn Taylor, to look him in the eyes, and you have to get in that situation. You need to tell me and reinforce the thought that you're my guy. You're going to be the star that you could be. And it's easy as a fan to say that is a bad decision, Glenn Taylor. It didn't make any sense. Clearly, he wasn't motivated. But as the culture goes with the Timberwolves, let's look at the past. What has our small market ever done for us in the past? We've lost KG. We've lost Sprewell. We've lost Cassell. We lost Billups. We lost Marbury. We've lost a lot of guys to free agency and a lot of young guys. When we lost KG, he was, what, 28, 27, in the middle of his dang prime? And who knows? I'm not saying we go win a title, but as a fan, you've lost a lot of good talent. And at the age of 22 years old, when the contract was to be had with Wiggins to be extended, if you're Glenn Taylor and you don't opt in or, you know, extend him, how do you explain that to the public?
And quick before Sky answers that, I think that at that age, at 22 years old, when he came in, his first season, he was really, really good for us. And I think that if we don't offer him that contract and he goes to, let's say he goes home to Toronto.
He had 24.5 points a game, shooting 45%.
Let's say he goes home to Toronto and he becomes a superstar. What kind of look is that for Glenn Taylor, saying we had him in our organization, we could have offered him 5 years, $180 million or whatever we offered him, and we didn't?
I
think that Taylor needed to offer that to him, and he accepted it, which he should have. If you're going to get that contract extension offered to you, there's no doubt in my mind that you take that every time, especially coming off your rookie contract. If he goes to Toronto or anywhere else and becomes a superstar, that is not a good look for our organization.
Right.
And now that puts Towns in a situation where he could think, hey, Wiggins was here for his first 4 years, and now he left and he's a superstar. Where could I go, or what could I do if I leave here and now I can become the next superstar? I think that it looked really good and really bad for us that we offered Wiggins that contract, but it's something we needed to do.
it definitely put us on the map, and that's what we were struggling to do as an organization, mm-hmm. as a Timberwolves organization, mm-hmm. was just being on the map. And I think you can relate that to, like, the Tom Thibodeau era and the Jimmy Butler era. As much as people, like, hated what happened with that, it kind of put us on a map in a way that it made the Timberwolves relevant again in the NBA. Like, we went to the playoffs for the first time in how long? 14 years. We were winning, and we were instilling a culture. As much as Towns or Wiggins or the young guys didn't like it, we were actually changing. So back to the Wiggins contract, it was definitely necessary for the Wolves to do that, in that sense that it had the possibility that we could be put on the map again.
Hey. So quickly before we run over to the Twins, okay? Let's really glance over quickly. Wiggins, I'm just gonna ask you, Sky, and I'm gonna ask Brent. Wiggins with a new athletic trainer, weights trainer, is there gonna be a difference?
There's not gonna be a difference, hands down. Okay. Not at all.
And Brent, do you have any?
I don't think there's gonna be a difference for him body wise. I don't think it's gonna help motivate him to do. Maybe it will. Maybe it will say, hey, we got a new guy in. This is not the guy that brought me in. This is not Tibbs. This is not Layden. This is Rosas, who is brand new. He is the president of basketball operations. He could trade me in a heartbeat, mm-hmm. if I don't get my act together. And what do people around the league think of Andrew Wiggins right now?
I don't think Andrew Wiggins thinks like that as a player. I don't really think any player thinks like that. They are just trying to...
But I think that maybe this will help Wiggins get his head on straight and say, I need to turn things around, because after my, granted he does have, 4 years left on his deal, after this, what is he going to get? Because people around the league are looking at him right now, and us as fans are looking at him right now as he could be labeled as a bust.
Let me just be honest. If I'm looking at I'm a GM, and of course, if I'm getting hired and I'm a relatively new wave of GMs or POBOs being signed, you can't ignore the new analytics in the game. And if you're looking at pure analytics, which you're fed every day from your guys in the scouting department, in the analytical department, which we currently employ 6 guys, then of course you're seeing what Wiggins' truth is. And what is it? It's not efficiency or outside of the paint, or even close to it. It's not enough attempts inside the paint. It's a lack of will to go inside, because not necessarily of not having the effort. I think it's because he hasn't worked on his handle. And when you can't drive to the hoop, it's because you don't have a good enough handle. You can't protect the ball the right way. And that just comes from working on the offseason. So I want to conclude that. I personally do not believe, I mean, there might be a slight uptake or, you know, in his efficiency, but is that enough? Is he a willing defender 80% of the game? I don't sell that. I can't buy it.
All right, before we move on to the Twins here, I just want to give out a quote that Daryl Morey gave out this morning when it was announced that Gerson Rosas was going to be joining the Minnesota Timberwolves. There was a report that Daryl Morey was quoted saying, I wish Gerson nothing but the best, but I wish he would have went to an Eastern Conference team. So that tells me about Rosas that he's going to be a really, really good mind for our organization, and that Daryl Morey thinks the world of Rosas. And that is, for the Timberwolves side of things, really, really good to have that mind, and really good to have that mind want to join our organization and lead us into the future. But, fellas, that topic is over. The Twins are one of the hottest teams in the league right now. Coming out of spring training, did you see that happening?
Man, this is a good time to be a Twins fan. This is as good as it gets. If you're watching a night to night basis, it's fun. Like, even the nights when we get shut out, or there's a good pitcher on the mound and we can't do much. It's like the next night. We respond. We've been responding. When we lost to the Blue Jays, that's the most impressive thing to me about the Minnesota Twins. When we, for instance, we come off doing really well against the Indians, doing really well against the Royals in a two-game road trip. And then going over to Toronto was like, what's going on? We lose 3 out of 4 at Toronto Blue Jays. And everyone's like, oh, no. Here we go. Come back to mediocrity. There's your Minnesota Twins. And the bullpen's falling apart. Everything's dying. But no. Like, the next series, we come and we take 2 out of 3. No, we sweep the Orioles. And then we play Houston. We take the first game with Odorizzi. We lose the next 2. And then we sweep the Orioles again. And now we take another game from Houston. And we're looking pretty good in game 3 of the series. It's pretty impressive. The way we respond, we beat Verlander. Now, we didn't put up runs against him, but we beat him. We found a way to beat Corey Kluber when we didn't hit our best, but Marwin Gonzalez gets a big hit to start off our first, you know, game of the year. We've made a lot of big plays with our hitting. I don't think hitting will be a question. Top 5 in the AL is a safe bet that our offense at worst, even with a couple injuries, like a Buxton going down or a Polanco going through a massive hitting slump maybe in the second half, something like that. I think we can withstand that offensively. My question is definitely with the bullpen. So,
well, before we get to the bullpen, let's talk about our starters here for a minute. You look at our starting rotation, who is our weak link right now? Michael Pineda. And when Pineda came over, granted he needed surgery, he needed Tommy John, but he was a stud for the Yankees when he was there. He pitched really, really well for the New York Yankees. But let's look at his year so far this year. Last night, he was up against the Houston Astros. He went 5 innings. He had 9 hits, 5 runs, which all were earned, might I add. He had 5 earned runs in 5 innings. His outing before that was against the same Houston Astros team. Mm-hmm. Okay. In that game, he went 4. 4 innings. So a combined outing against the Astros, he's had 9 innings. In the first matchup, he let up 8 hits. So combined, that's 17 hits against the Houston Astros.
I mean, it wasn't. I've not been impressed with Pineda, but let's just keep this relevant. How long has Pineda been out of the league for? He didn't play last year, and I'm pretty sure the year before that's when he had Tommy John.
Yeah, I get that, but he's had 9 earned runs in 2 starts against the Houston Astros. So let's look at his season in review now. He said 29 innings, giving up 37 hits, 20 runs, all earned. 20 runs all earned at a 6.21 ERA. Okay. He's given up 6 home runs, 6 walks in 29 innings. I like that. 6 walks is good in 29 innings.
The impressive thing you watch Pineda, and if you get a chance to watch all his starts, is two things. One being Pineda, when he starts his first start of the year, it was a 4-inning stint, right? And Perez came in for the last couple innings. But he pitches 4 innings, I believe, against the Indians?
It was the Indians, yes.
And he pitched 4 innings, and I think he let 0 runs, or maybe 1. And pitched great. But you watch, and he struggles against the Astros, whatever. But my thing is it's a pitcher, if you look at his progression, it's a pitcher who clearly is lacking command of his fastball. And if you watch that, it's because what does Pineda's Fangraph show you his whole career? He was a 94 to 95 fastball guy. He started the year throwing 89 and 90 to the Cleveland Indians. Okay, then he ramped it up. His next start to 91, he ramped it up to 93. Now he's around that 92, 93, 94. To me, it's a guy that's still trying to figure out his fastball, get his feel back in the game. He hasn't been around the MLB level for over 18 months. And that's catastrophic to me. I mean, look at what Trevor May. It took him a little bit to get going. I know he came back last year and did a good job, but just to get rolling again, it's hard to make an evaluation of Michael Pineda because of what happened the last 2 years. But I'll move on from him because I think right now it's clear he's our 5th starter guy. And if he ends up having elbow soreness, it could be Fernando Romero. But
so if we want to move on from him, let's talk about our ace here, Jose Berrios. He's had 39 innings this year, 30 hits, 13 earned runs for a 2.9 ERA. He has 41 Ks in 39 innings, allowing 8 walks. If we can get Jose Berrios to produce at the rate he's been all year long with the lineup that we have, I think every time he's on the mound, we have a very, very, very good chance to win.
It's impressive watching Berrios pitch because, I mean, we all know Berrios' fastball is special. And it's not because his velocity is Noah Syndergaard's. It's because his velocity is matched with amazing movement. It's like a two-seam sinker every time, and he can command that inside high to the lefties, inside high to the righties. And then, but what makes Jose Berríos maybe from that, I'll go almost a tier three of ace pitchers, like you have tier one with Noah Syndergaard, Jacob deGrom, Corey Kluber, Verlander. Chris Sale is not feeling it right now, but usually Chris Sale, I think he'll figure it out. And Blake Snell, you could add him to the list maybe too. You see guys with three plus pitches all the time. If their fastball's off, because if you listen to Justin Morneau or Jack Morris on the broadcast on FSN, you hear a lot of times how these great pitchers, like Madison Bumgarner has a great story of Game 7 of the World Series, talks about how his fastball was not there at all the first four innings, and his curveball was not there at all. So he goes to a splitter and a changeup. And when you can go from a splitter and a changeup, and you don't even have a fastball or a curveball, and you're throwing that in Game 7 of the World Series where you just have pitched the last two games straight to get the Giants to Game 7, I mean, that's impressive. And what Berríos is doing is he added the changeup. He always threw the changeup, but you look at his usage rate, his changeup usage last year was below 3% out of all his pitches. And he's going fastball, curveball, fastball, curveball. And now you're seeing a three-pitch mix. Like, you look at the Orioles matchup. Against the Orioles, he threw his curveball 60% of the time, his fastball 20% of the time, and a little bit of the changeup. If you look at Jose Berríos' next start, then it's like the opposite. He can beat you in multiple ways. To me, that's what makes him a great ace.
Yeah, it is great that he added that changeup. And one of the greatest pitchers ever in the Twins organization had the best changeup, Johan Santana. I'm not saying he's going to be Johan Santana, but it's really nice that he added that. And his fastball, to me, is almost like, it's almost like two pitches because it moves so much. It affects the batter's eyes because it moves so much. And when he has a changeup to go along with that, it's just really good with the hitters. Fuck that.
I think Jose has done a really, really good job so far this year. But what has really impressed me about the Twins in general is Rocco Baldelli and his usage that he has and different lineups he has given out this year. I think he's done a really good job at rotating our lineup so that everyone stays ready. It doesn't matter who we are playing, really. He rotates the lineup so well and where he sees fit to keep guys ready in game action. You look at two nights ago in our opener against the Houston Astros, going against Justin Verlander, he started A-Ray Adrianza. And who won the game for us? A-Ray.
Yep.
On one pitch. He pulled the ball to right field over the fence in the long run of the game.
Against who?
The Houston Astros.
Verlander.
Right?
Right. That's one of the best pitchers in the game. He sat most of our... No, I shouldn't say most of our studs. He sat two or three of our bigger hitters and played Adrianza. That just proves that at this point in the season, he would rather get guys playing time and get guys comfortable at the plate and get guys comfortable in the field. Because A-Ray, he made a few plays in that game, like the play in the first inning, where he made a diving play at third. Yes. And if he doesn't stop that ball, they might score a run or two.
That might be two runs.
And that could have saved the game for us, because now Houston gets two runs and they got their ace and their horse in the mound dealing. After he hit his home run in the third inning, Houston was locked in after A-Ray hit his home run.
Yeah.
And Verlander, he let up one or two hits after that.
Mm-hmm.
If they were to get those two runs, it would have been over for us.
I think it does a lot in the clubhouse. You can talk all about... I mean, I think that's a great point that you make, because you can say, well, we need wins. Why are we starting Adrianza? We can start Marlon. We can start Polanco. We can start... You know, we can make all those decisions, but it's a valuable thing to do it now in the beginning of the season. I think Terry Francona is a great example. He loves getting his bench as many at-bats as he can in the first half of the year. And when you get a lot of guys involved from your bench early on in the season, you're preparing these guys later on the season. Like, if you're expecting Adrianza to have 50 at-bats or 70 at-bats and it comes September and Jorge Polanco goes down, you expect him to fill that hole. He has no experience this year that's relevant to fill that hole. You want to get these guys early at-bats in the season so they're prepared for the injuries later. And maybe you sustain or you almost ward off the injuries by keeping guys more fresh. I mean, I'm not saying that you need to bench Buxton three times a week, but it's not a bad idea to keep the rotation, which I think we should credit Rocco Baldelli a lot. He's not only kept a consistent rotation, but he's literally finding time for Jake Cave to play more than twice a week. He's finding time for Williams Acedillo to get three games when healthy a week at least. Mitch Garver has played the exact same games behind the plate as Jason Castro has. That's a big deal. And I think when that's going to pay a lot of benefits for us come September. Because what is more beneficial of having three catchers when Acedillo is healthy all over 200 at-bats by September comes? Because now all of them have not only batting experience, but what else? Calling a baseball game. And that goes a long way with your pitchers, especially when you have injuries. I think that that versatility that Baldelli's drawing out for us, it's patience now, and it's going to pay off, I think, even more so later. And you look at the schedule in late July August.
It gets really soft for us.
It gets really soft. You get a lot of White Sox, Tigers, Royals games, and a lot of them stack up. You have a 12-game homestand against the White Sox, Royals, and then the White Sox again. Like, that's, I don't know.
But let's just look at our lineup here for a minute. All the guys that we have brought in, and even the guys that we had last year, are hitting at such an insane rate. We have 50 home runs right now. We're not even to May. We have 50. What were we at last year? 28? 27? 27?
Yeah.
So we're a ginormous uptick.
Yeah.
And you look at the guys that we brought in. Cruz, he's hit, what, 4?
5, yeah.
Gonzalez has hit 1.
Yep.
Krohn has hit 3 or 4.
5.
5.
How many have Kepler hit?
He's 7.
I was going to add that too, but look at, it's the guys that we had last year that are doing a majority of the damage for us.
Oh, that's a great point. I mean, because you can talk about, and Falvey has done a great job. Falvey and Levine have with adding Marwin and adding, like you said,
this front office has done a tremendous job bringing in guys.
CJ and Marwin and Jonathan Scope. I mean, talk about an underrated value. I said this the other day, and I think a lot of people this is the eye test. There's something to be said when a guy in now a league where we do a lot of positional alignment and shifts, okay? It's something to be said with double plays almost being small, like decreasing because of the shift.
Especially with Odorizzi on the mound.
Exactly. But the nice thing about Jonathan Scope, I think that we don't understand the value defensively, is his ability to turn the double play. He's got one of the better arms at when turning the double play. A lot of times guys have to set their feet, pump going forward. And if you watch Jonathan Scope, it's a small play. But it's impressive to see if Polanco throws it off the base, like Brian Dozier could not make half the throw that Jonathan Scope could last year. And when you look at the defensive run save at second base, Scope's double the amount of what Dozier ever has in his career.
And that's where you give our front office just a pat on the back by bringing in these guys. Because you look at just Nelson Cruz, for example, who is almost 40 years old. Mm-hmm. He is, 37, 38 years old?
Yep.
He's batting the middle of our lineup right now and producing for us at almost 40 years old. And he is one of the best clubhouse guys in the majors that we could have brought in as a free agent.
Oh, yeah.
It's really hard to find a mix of production in the middle of our lineup and a clubhouse guy. And that is what Nelson Cruz is. So credit and kudos to our front office for bringing in 4 guys that are great clubhouse guys that also produce on the field. Because if our young guys can see that and see how Nelson Cruz is, his batting average is up, his OBP is up, his slugging is up, his home runs. I mean, It's just insane how he can be that good, and it's not about me. It's about what we're doing as a team, what we're doing as an organization, just stuff like that. To see that, put me aside and put us in front. And when I'm 37, 38 years old, I need to be that guy and be the clubhouse guy.
Yep.
But let's talk about something that's really close to the heart for Brandon here. Jake Odorizzi and his spin rate right now is off the charts with his fastball and his curveball and his...
It's exciting to watch. I think we all know if you watch the game against the Astros, the whole game, Odorizzi could have pitched 9 innings. And I think we just did the right thing, of course, by... We just had 100 pitches by the end of the 7th inning.
Brian, one of the best relievers in the game.
You can't deny that. And our bullpen's been actually holding its own and more the last couple weeks, surprisingly, against, you know, fairly good offenses with the Astros are part of it. But Jake Odorizzi's got two things that he didn't have last year and he's never had when he was a Tampa Bay Ray, when Rocco Baldelli was the coach. There's a reason why we have a lot of vested interest in Jake Odorizzi as a future of our team. One, Derek Falvey used to work in Tampa Bay. Two, Derek Falvey and Rocco Baldelli worked together in the office together in the Tampa Bay's for 3 years. And who was also pitching there? It was Archer, the number one, and their number two was Jake Odorizzi. That was their rotation. And Jake Odorizzi, you look at his career ERA, correct me if I'm wrong, but he's a pretty darn good pitcher. But he's, again, never had what he has now. Like, he's always thrown 92, 93. That's not the difference. It's what Wes Johnson has done with Jake Odorizzi. What Wes Johnson has incorporated with Martin Perez, who's gone from 92 miles per hour last year off an injury to 96, 97.
And just aside from his uptick in speed for Martin Perez, Martin Perez could barely make it in the league last year because of his ERA and his innings pitched and his... He was upwards in the double digits of ERA, and now you look at him right now, he's sitting at around, 3 in the ERA? 3.3, 3.4?
And Wes Johnson talks about this. If you listen to some of the FSN pregame stuff, just coming in some of the podcasts with Jim Suhan, but he talks about how he wants his pitchers to explode off your back heel, off the rubber. A lot of times as pitchers, we're using the side of our foot to explode off the rubber. A lot of times we're using, when we're stepping forward to get our first step, we're using our toes to get momentum towards the mound. He wants the pitchers, and Cal Gibson has talked on and on and on about this in spring training, to get your heels off the mound and explode forward. And what that does is get you that little bit extra extension to the mound so you can release quicker and the velocity is higher. And it takes a lot of, according to Kyle Gibson and Jake Odorizzi, pressure off the elbow. And when pitchers are throwing, you know, calmer, and it's less of a wild motion in between, you start to see higher spin rates. And that's what I'm really impressed about with Jake Odorizzi, is that his spin rates, like an average fastball spin rate is roughly 1,200, okay? And an average curveball spin rate is roughly 2,400. And you look at Verlander. He's got one of the greatest curveballs in the game, right? Still, really old Verlander, still got one of the best curveballs in the game. So does Kluber. Their spin rates are about 2,700, 2,600, elite level. Okay, Strasburg's there with him. And Jake Odorizzi's not far. And you want to look at his spin rates, it's like, oh, was he doing this before? No. Jake Odorizzi was an average spin rate for fastball throwing a 92. People hit his fastball. But you watch against the Astros game, go play back the tape. 4 pitches in a row, fastball, outside of the plate to Altuve and Correa. Boom, boom. And Bregman. Swing and miss, swing and miss, swing and miss. When it was 0-2 to Correa, 1-2, he threw the same pitch, fastball right down, like in the letter high. Correa couldn't touch it. It's because of his deception. He's holding it behind his body more, and the pushing off the mounds allowing him to get a higher spin rating according to the analytics. And if you drive those stats up, you can say all you want, well, Jake Odorizzi is coming back to earth. But the tape does not lie. If I'm being honest, unless Jose Barrios does something even better, more impressive tomorrow, I've been more impressed with Jake Odorizzi's last 2 starts than Barrios. I'm not saying Barrios is not the ace. He is our ace. But Jake Odorizzi could be our 2.
All right, Sky, we need to get Brandon off his high horse here in the Minnesota Twins. Let's move on to something else. My favorite weekend of the year has come and gone. NFL draft weekend was this past weekend. And I really think, I don't know about you, Sky, but I think the Vikings hit a home run at this draft. I don't know how many of you guys looked at my mock draft that I posted a week ago, but I mocked the Vikings at getting Jawan Taylor in the first round.
Come on.
Who I thought, coming out of Florida, was one of the best offensive tackles in the draft. And just by doing a lot of research and seeing what other mocks had him at, there were a lot of mocks that had Jawan Taylor going in the top 10.
Oh, yeah. 7th, 8th, 9th.
And so when I did my mock draft online and Jawan Taylor fell to me, I took him in a heartbeat because he was a top 10 player.
I was surprised when the Bengals, at was it 11, when it, they passed up. They're trying to protect whoever it is, Dalton or whoever their future quarterback. I'm surprised that when you make that point, like, where did he get picked at?
He got picked in the second round. I think it was third to the Jaguars took him.
I mean, value, that's a big one. I mean, are you asking, do you guys think that we should have added an alignment earlier? Or are you okay with Drew? What do you think of that?
I think that, well, just for me personally, in my mock draft, when we were there at 18 and Jawan Taylor was there, I wanted us to take him just for the sake of my mock draft. But my number two guy all along was Garrett Bradbury. And I really think we got a steal with Garrett Bradbury at 18 overall because like our organization said from the minute we drafted him, and every analytic guy has said this, and a lot of the analysts have said, Garrett Bradbury was the top lineman in this draft, and he was one of the top signers to come out of the draft in a long time. But for us to get him at 18, what does that mean for Pat O'Flynn?
He's going to get moved over to guard.
Yeah.
Which you get basically two picks for your one pick, which was a good idea.
So if we move Pat Elflein to guard and we sign Josh Klein, and now we draft in the 5th round the guard from Oklahoma. 4th round. The guard from Oklahoma, Drew Samia, who was a really, really good guard for Oklahoma. He, this year, was the second team All-American.
Let's talk about that. Okay, Drew Samia. Okay, according to, is it Jeff Saturday, who works for ESPN? And a couple guys, are, you know, just listening to them talk about him post the combine, they're saying that, you know, Cody Ford was really solid in pass protection, okay? And maybe that's a reason also, beyond just we needed a center and we love Bradbury, maybe that's a reason why we didn't want Cody Ford, okay? And maybe that's a reason why a lot of teams, according to Mel Kiper, didn't really believe that much in Cody Ford coming closer to the draft. A lot of people started to think Drew Samia is an overall better offensive lineman. And I'm listening to when he got with, was it Wabi and Paul's, I listened to him talk about how much, I mean, he sounds like a guy who's just nasty. Like, and if you're talking about old linemen that we're missing, it's a guy who just gets in these battles after the line, after the play's over. And what, I mean, I'm sorry, Elflein, he seems pretty good, but he doesn't seem nasty enough. He doesn't seem bit, you know, he, what is he, 6'2", 290 pounds at best. This Drew Samia, 6'5", I mean, if he adds 10 more pounds, he could, 320, and the guy can move left and right with balance. I like Bradbury a lot, but for the value, if you want to turn on the best value picks by a couple guys that are reviewing things, look at what they're grading Samia at. Like, he was ranked by most guys between the 50 and 60 slot. We drafted him at
114?
Something like that, around 100. We got a great value who might be a better overall lineman in the NFL scheme, modern day scheme, than Cody Ford.
But now with that selection and us not taking a tackle in the early rounds, what does that mean? Because now we have Pat O'Flynn, who's a center slash guard. We have Josh Klein, who last year at Tennessee played both guard spots. We drafted Garrett Bradbury, who's either going to play center or guard for us. I'm going to slot him in at center, like Sky said, and we're going to move Pat O'Flynn over to guard. And now we draft Drew Samia, Sky. I don't know. We have 4 center slash guards for 3 spots. Do we move one to tackle? I mean, I don't know where there's room for all 4 guys. We're going to have to sit one. And maybe we sit Drew Samia for a year and see what Josh Klein has. Because he could be on a prove-it deal where if he doesn't produce, he could be gone and now we can easily slide in Drew Samia. Or even if he struggles this year. So Drew Samia is going to be game ready.
You guys included O'Neal, right? You talk about Brian O'Neal.
I think you definitely need
him. I think he was one of the most impressive linemen to me last year.
I think he got voted by the players, the Vikings teammates, as the best improved player or something
most
like that.
Improved player on the offensive side.
Yeah.
And watching the tape, he's a, what, converted lineman or tight end from Pittsburgh, right? And he
this did, is the thing with that. We're now trying to convert to a zone blocking scheme.
Which and, uses two tight end sets.
Well, and the thing is, you need athletic linemen when you do a zone blocking scheme, because when you do a zone blocking scheme, you want your guards and your tackles to get out to that second level and block in the second level.
And you need to pull a lot.
Yeah, which they might be blocking linebackers, cornerbacks, athletic people. So you need your linemen to be athletic.
And if you want to talk about fit, how good did Gary Kubiak do with getting Irv Smith Jr.? Because I'm telling you, he's the guy who went out and got him or wanted him, or one of the scouts along with Gary Kubiak. I mean, you talk about getting, I mean, what do the Patriots do so well at exposing you? If you want, they're going to expose, if you're going to put eight guys in a box, they're going to expose your single high safety. Okay, they're going to expose that real fast. And they're going to get two tight ends that could show block or that could pull out. And they're going to do two of your best receivers. We got Diggs and Thielen. Like, we don't need, that's why we don't qualify, or we don't do the qualifier to Laquon Treble, because Irv Smith Jr. is going to fill the hole. He can block. You know what? So people don't know what Irv Smith Jr. was in Alabama? A really good fullback. Played fullback in about 20% of the plays. And they use, and I don't know how much they have belief in C.J. Ham to this point. I like him. But Irv Smith Jr. is very comfortable playing fullback. He did a lot so under Tua. So that's an interesting role I think we add with Irv Smith in the second round at 50. A lot of people liked him more than the second tight end that got picked from Iowa.
I think that Irv Smith Jr.'s grade was a late first-round pick, and for us to get him 18th overall in the second round was a really good value for us. Granted, we traded up to 10th to get him, but I really think that we got to steal on Irv Smith, because like you said, he can play opposite of Kyle Rudolph, or he can play in the slot. He is a big body that, who are you going to put on Irv Smith? Are you going to put a hybrid linebacker on him?
It's going to be a linebacker, and it's going to be tough because, yeah, he ran a 4.63, and that's like, oh, that's not the most impressive.
That's really impressive for a tight end.
It is. Yeah. It is impressive, but what's even more intriguing to me is you watch his route running. If it's after his first three steps, it's impressive what he can do laterally in his step, in his route tree. He can do a lot of things that second-round receivers and third-round receivers, when there was a runner receivers, couldn't do in the route tree, and that's a tight end. To me, that's impressive. Irv Smith Jr., now, we don't need to keep Rudolph forever, but if we can keep him this year and maybe he reduces that salary a little bit, cut it in half, or lose a shot of a million or two, that gives us some flexibility. And I like wouldn't you want to see just for 1 year? Like, because who do the Redskins have that was so athletic, similar to Irv Smith?
Jordan Reed.
Very similar player. If you look at their talent, I would love to see Rudolph and Irv Smith and Dalvin Cook, and I like Alexander Mattison.
I was just going to bring up Alexander Mattison.
I like him.
We got him in the third round out of Boise State when there were a lot of other running backs on the board. But to me, the other running backs on the board really are very similar to Dalvin Cook. Mm-hmm. And what has plagued Dalvin Cook so far in his career? Injuries, right? Yeah. He has not proven he can stay in the field. Yeah. And that's where, when I threw up my mock draft, I had us taking Bryce Love in the sixth round, I think it was. But after I sit and look at that, what plagued Bryce Love this year? He tore his ACL. So I don't, when I go back and look at that, we can't take another running back like Bryce Love, who is Dalvin Cook in a nutshell.
Yeah.
He is the same exact thing Dalvin Cook is. We can't go take a flyer on a guy that tore his ACL last year. Could have waited in the sixth round, taken Bryce Love. If he was there in the sixth round, I would have taken him in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
But he got picked, I think it was in the fourth or fifth round. But Alexander Mattison could be really good for us. He reminds me of a Mike Tolbert type player who is short and a bowling ball. If you can give him the ball in the goal line, he's going to give us a lot of production this year.
I like the idea of, you know, I mean, push Mike Boone. Okay, I don't know if Rock Thomas is going to do much, but push Mike Boone as that second, third running back. But Alexander Mattison, I don't want to get too crazy about him until, like, preseason comes. But I think that's my favorite pick in this draft, besides obviously Bradbury. I think he's going to be a really good center. But Alexander Mattison, to me, if you, kind of what you're saying, but I see a little bit of a I don't know why people, you watch his tape, it's like this guy's explosive. He's got way more speed than his 40 time shows. Way more time.
Or he way more speed. The holes very quickly.
I see a really good combination now, a little different, but I like what our idea is. Can we get not the same exact thing, but a Mark Ingram and a Kamara combination? And then can you use, like, because Alexander Mattison can catch. He had 50 receptions in 3 years, but he got 35 of those in two. So Madison and Cook, I think that's a good combination to have back there. There's not a lot of running backs. I don't think the NFC North has besides the no. Who didn't the Bears lose Howard and they lost? They lost Howard.
Howard went to the Eagles.
Mm-hmm. So in a trade, so I don't know. How do you get better at the running back position? It's a guy who can kind of add a different element to our team, like Brent's saying, and a guy who can get the goal line and take less wear and tear off Dalvin Cook.
Just moving on from Alexander Mattison and our earlier round picks, Brandon and I talked about this the other day extensively. I think we got a steal in the seventh round with the Oregon wide receiver Dylan Mitchell. Just looking back at his production at Oregon, he had 75 receptions last year and 10 touchdowns.
Yeah,
he could really slide in and be a really good slot receiver for us.
Oh yeah.
So if you add him to the mix, granted, I don't want to get too high like you said on Alexander Mattison.
Yeah.
I don't want to get too high on Mitchell until we see him play.
Yeah.
But if you can add him in the mix along with Diggs and Thielen, if you can get him in the film room and on the field working with those two guys, that just, even look at the grind that Thielen and Diggs had to go through to become what they are. Thielen was undrafted. Diggs got drafted really late. Mitchell got drafted really late. So if he can just get in the film room and on the field and see the work that these two put in, and he can become a weapon in the slot along with Rudolph and Irv Smith at the tight ends, we become really dangerous to deal with. And that opens up lanes for Cook and Mattison to run through. And that alone is going to help. Our biggest issue last year was our offensive line. If we can get all of our weapons up to par and playing at our potential, I think our line will improve immensely just from that standpoint of not having to feel so pressured because teams can't sit and blitz us 50 and 60% of the time of the game.
Yep. And let's just be honest. I am not, after watching last year, at the end of that year, I was covering my head watching Kirk Cousins play down the stretch. And it's really easy, again, it's kind of like the Wiggins thing. It's really easy just to say Kirk Cousins is bad, right? But if you watch, and I'm screaming at the TV late games, please, Stefanski or whoever our coordinator at the point is, please call the play action. Because if you watch Kirk Cousins on rollouts to the right, he is special. And he's one of the better quarterbacks in play action. And why if you look at the top five quarterbacks, go rank them. Drew Brees, I'm talking about last year. Tom Brady, Patrick Mahomes, Aaron Rodgers,
and
Russell Wilson. I'm not going to put Ben Roethlisberger in there. It's Russell Wilson. You want to do those five? Look at who leads top five in play action. It's not running quarterbacks or even what's his face from Buffalo. It's actually the top five quarterbacks in the league minus Tom Brady. All five of those guys, four of those guys, lead the NFL in play action percentage rate in a game, and why is Kirk Cousins, like, he was 20th last year in play action play calls for him. But when he plays for run, he was the best in completion percentage. Use the guy. Like, half his touchdowns were off the play action. Use the guy. And I'd like to see our tight ends used more. Like, why does all the great quarterbacks make their tight ends at least pretty damn good? It's because it's their third option. And if you're not in a play action, you're not seeing your tight end as much, to be honest. You're not releasing him because it's hard for tight ends, unless you're, a more athletic Irv Smith, to get separation from a linebacker. Like, you're Rudolph and you're 29 years old. So we need to, get the linebackers committing so we can open up Rudolph. That's how I look at it.
I think our biggest win of the offseason was the addition of three coaches. Gary Kubiak comes over from Denver. He knows how to win. He knows how to produce play from your quarterback and from your just from your offense in general. He's going to be a great advisor to Mike Zimmer. And I think the best hire we had was Rick Dennison. Him as an offensive line coach, you look at the places he's been. No matter what the offensive line came in at before he got there, let's say they're 28th in the league. When he got there, he bumped them to 24th. Or if they were 24th, he got them to 22nd. Granted, he just moved up a little bit. But if you can get Gary Kubiak and Rick Dennison in here to work with our linemen, and you look at Gary Kubiak, what did he do last year? He sat in Denver's front office and just scouted college kids. Mike Zimmer was quoted after the draft saying that. That's why we took Garrett Bradbury, and that's why we took Irv Smith. Because all Gary Kubiak did was sit in his office and watch game film or go to games and watch kids play in person. So I think Gary Kubiak and his knowledge and his advice to Zimmer, that's one thing I think Zimmer does really well, is he puts his ego aside and says, hey, I'm a defensive guy. I need help with the offense. Yeah. And he brought in an elite offensive mind.
Yeah, I mean, there was so much hate at the end of last year. And even the year before we get blown out to the Eagles, of how even me at times, like, man, is Zimmer on the hot seat? Is he the right coach? Can he steer us to the right direction, to the promised land? And I think Brent says it really well. Mike Zimmer is a good coach, because since the day he's got here, he took over as we had the worst defense in the damn NFL. And since then, it took him a year, because we got to 18th that first year. After that first year, it's been lights out. Like, we've been top 10 in points allowed, point and yards against, the last 5 years of Mike Zimmer. And we've been top 5 3 of those years. So for me, it's like you said, Mike Zimmer, he's got the defense. And he can develop cornerbacks and D-backs. And he brings in, you know what? I like the balls of our team to go and say, you know, this isn't working. Like, we get guys in and out, and we don't waste 2 or 3 years, because we don't have 2 or 3 years for these guys to get older and age. Like, how many guys have we got? Norv Turner was just here, like, 2.5, 3 years ago. We've gone through a lot of coaches. Stefanski could be gone this year. Who knows? 5 games in, but I like that we're trying to find something. And even if Stefanski's not the answer,
which I do think, I think Kevin Stefanski is going
to
be really
but
good.
But like Brent says, who can we fall back to? A guy who's been a head coach for more than 10 years in his career.
And even before we brought in Kubiak and Rick Dennison, and even Clint Kubiak, who is Gary's son, working with our quarterbacks, who was our offensive line coach before Rick Dennison got here?
The guy who died.
Tony Sperano, who sadly passed away before our season started last year. He did a really good job for our offensive line. So that just goes to show that Zimmer doesn't care about, hey, I'm the head coach, we're doing things my way, it's my way or the highway. He's going to bring in guys that know more than he does on the offensive side. And that's what, kudos to Mike Zimmer for doing that, because I don't know if a lot of guys will do that in the league, where it's my way, I'm the head coach, we're doing this, I'm going to run the show. Mike Zimmer passes things off.
Now, there's some things that I don't like about Mike Zimmer. Like, one, okay, the way he's handled kickers, that's not what you want to do with their mindset. You really taking away all their confidence when a guy like Daniel Carlson comes into preseason. I don't know if anyone remembers this, but he purposely puts out Daniel Carlson again to kick a field goal after missing against the Oakland Raiders. And then to end the game, he purposely doesn't allow him to kick. And after the game, he makes a comment in a preseason game in his rookie year saying, yeah, we decided to go for two because our kicker didn't do his job the last time. And I just don't understand. See, that's where, with me, Mike Zimmer, you have to do a better job recognizing your players and recognizing what's probably going to help them in a game-like situation. With kickers, different animal, and I think Mike Zimmer needs to leave them alone unless you know, he's found a different path. But I like Mike Zimmer for a lot of other reasons, the defense, the cornerback development, he establishes. You can have the offense, go ahead. But this is a big year for me. If Cousins doesn't get the job done, if we go 500 or 8-8 or below, does Mike Zimmer hold his job? I know we extended for one more year, and another thing is Kirk Cousins on the trading block because he does have a year left after this. So
he could be on the trading block, but I don't think anybody is going to get his. Nobody was going to take on his contract.